Hello, everybody. This is Greg Gutfeld. This is The One. Very excited. I have Professor Brett Weinstein on today. If you don't know who he is, that is your loss. I feel sorry for you. I could explain who he is, but that would take like 30 minutes. So I'm going to boil it down to this one campus controversy you might have heard about. A large group of students were protesting a day of absence and a day of presence at Evergreen State College. Professor Weinstein responded that rather than leave the campus, which is what they wanted him to do, he would stay. As a result, the students essentially berated him, demanded that he apologize and resign. The incident lasted maybe 15 minutes, but it catapulted Brett Weinstein into the national conversation, and he is now kind of an interesting intellectual phenomenon. So he ended up resigning from and leaving the college along with his wife, Heather. And I actually am very, very happy that this happened, because if what had happened at Evergreen State College hadn't happened, I never would have found out who Brett Weinstein is and ended up listening to a lot of his interviews on YouTube, which are always – you always find something interesting or phenomenal. Professor Weinstein, how are you?
I'm doing all right. Thanks for having me on the show, Greg. I would say if people want to understand what happened at Evergreen, they should check out the article that Heather and I wrote for the Washington Examiner. It does a pretty good job of explaining what happened, and because we wrote it, it's all accurate. The story is complicated, and so lots of reports have been a little off.
Yeah.
But anyway, it's there for your listeners if they want to find it.
It's amazing, Professor, how you are now a member of the alt-right.
Yes, I was as shocked at that as anybody.
It's amazing. I mean, it is because you are an original Occupy Wall Streeter, and you're a progressive. You were a supporter of Bernie Sanders, and now because you're kind of outside, you've left this kind of bubble that you were supposed to be in, and now you're kind of part of this free thinking movement. You're being lumped in with a whole other group of characters. And that's how they shut you up, right?
Well, I don't think they're doing a very effective job at it. But yes, they seem to be searching for some cookie-cutter method for dismissing what you're calling the free thinker movement. And so, you know, we've been called far right, we've been called alt-right, we've been called a manosphere. And none of these things stick, because anybody who spends any time at all looking at who's involved in the discussion can see that it's non-ideological. We span the ideological spectrum from left to right. There are women deeply involved in the conversation. There's no axe to grind. And in fact, maybe that's what makes the conversation unique, is that the thing that unites us is an interest in figuring out what's true and how to explore it carefully and with nuance, rather than attempting to push an agenda.
Mm-hmm. And so now it's being lumped into this kind of new world called the intellectual dark web. The New York Times wrote a pretty hefty piece on it, featured you, your brother, Dave Rubin, Sam Harris, Joe Rogan, who is now a right winger. I didn't know that. Your wife, Christina Hoff Sommers, who's amazing. Can you explain the term intellectual dark web? Because it sounds like something you would have like on a fort, you know, in the woods. But it's just kind of a simplification of this explosion of free thinking.
Well, I'm hoping that shortly my brother, the mathematician Eric Weinstein, will explain what he meant by the term.
Yeah.
I think it makes everybody a bit uncomfortable, including Eric and me. But it is certainly an allusion to the idea that there is a mainstream marketplace of ideas which, for whatever reason, has become stale, and then there is an alternate marketplace of ideas. Mm-hmm. And the intellectual dark web is effectively made up of people who are willing to endure the stigma of being outside of the mainstream dialogue in order to have a richer and more interesting dialogue. Mm-hmm. And the most interesting thing about it is what a large audience seems interested in participating. So there are literally millions of people who are tuning into these intellectual discussions that go on for, you know, in Joe Rogan's case, they go on for 3 hours sometimes. So it's amazing how much hunger there is for more depth.
It's that's what it is. I really feel like it started since your story broke. That there was I sense a change, a different kind of activity in the world. There's more free thinkers. There's, I call weirdos, geniuses, and they're showing up everywhere. They're very eccentric, but was the audience always there, or is this some kind of unique phenomenon? Like, is the internet actually just revealing the audience, or is the internet revealing the artist? I don't know.
I think a number of things are going on. There's definitely some factors which are brand new. Mm-hmm. And then there's also a way in which eras differ. And sometimes you can have quite eccentric people in the mainstream. Mm-hmm. And when you have several of them, they can catalyze each other. And then sometimes the mainstream, for whatever reason, is so hostile that they have to be outsiders in some sense. And so we are now caught in a little bit of a paradox, because the outsiders have now gathered enough attention that people say, well, you're not really outsiders. But it is an organic grassroots alternative media that has popped up and has discovered an audience that I think even surprised the people who built it.
Right.
Sam Harris, Joe Rogan, Dave Rubin, these people have found huge numbers of people ready to listen, and I would be shocked if anybody wasn't surprised at the number of people involved.
Well, it's weird. It sucked me in, and I think it had to do – like, I talk to my friends about this all the time. I go, I'll listen to nothing but podcasts because of what I do for a living, I am thirsty for depth. I need to, like – I need to spend 3 hours on something, and I look at the – I look at, okay, people like the people you mentioned, you now have more students than you might have ever been able to have as a professor at a leafy campus. I mean, that's got to be pretty gratifying.
It is amazing in one way, and it's not just students. Mm-hmm. You know, I am a progressive, but I'm also a frustrated progressive.
Yeah.
I've watched the movement become feeble, and I'm not a believer in the policy proposals that the left is pushing, but I am a believer in many of the values. And to be in a position both to take my evolutionary work to a much larger audience is a remarkable opportunity, and the ability to speak a bit for a left that I haven't seen as a vibrant force in quite some time. That's also quite a privilege, and it's especially gratifying in that I'm not just talking to people who are sympathetic to the left. Many people on the right are actually willing to listen to arguments from somebody who's progressive on the basis that I have not signed up, I have very visibly not signed up for a lot of the foolishness that takes place on that side of the map.
Mm-hmm.
I do miss, though, there was something about teaching small numbers of people which can't be done when mm-hmm. your audience is tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands. And so I see a hunger in many of the people I'm now reaching. They're very excited about the evolutionary material that I'm most excited about, and that's an amazing thing to me, just to have that many people paying attention to a subject that I hold dear. On the other hand, there was something wonderful in the classroom of having 25 students, and at Evergreen we could teach our students. We taught one class full time, students took one class full time, and it could go on for a year.
Mm-hmm.
So the kind of depth that you can reach in that kind of a setting is not something that's easy to do in a discussion that gets broadcast on YouTube.
Yeah.
So I'm very heartened by the opportunity that this has provided, but there is also something that I miss about the personal connection with students and the ability to teach to an individual.
Yeah, I also think, too, that a byproduct to this is that because your expertise is evolutionary science, which I've always been – I've read so many books on it since, I don't know, the 90s, starting with Robert Wright and Helen Fisher and all that good stuff, that you're actually – you're kind of introducing that to a whole new audience that maybe – I don't know if you – conservatives – I don't want to insult anybody, but this was not an area that they were particularly attracted to. And you're kind of introducing that to them, and I think that that's really, really helpful in a way. I don't know.
Well, let's give that audience its due. Mm-hmm. I think there's been some discomfort around Darwinism mm-hmm. and an attempt to map it onto people. And
right.
that discomfort is about something that I think is actually accurate. In other words, Darwinism is still a pretty new science, mm-hmm. and I think it is only very recently that we have had enough vision and enough sophistication to understand, yes, we know that human beings are the product of evolution, but what exactly does that imply? That has been a difficult question to answer well, and I think people have been intuitively concerned about low-quality answers to that question.
Mm-hmm.
So not only am I able to introduce Darwinism to people who've been skeptical of it, but I'm hoping to level up that conversation so that people can see what a higher quality Darwinism has to say about people. And in the end, it's not only fascinating, but when you begin to see what that means about what it is to be a human being, it has implications that extend to how you live your everyday life, when you can trust your intuitions and when you can't, for example.
You know, when you talk about the elements of what makes a human, and recently I think I found I don't know if it was a speech of yours or maybe it was just a conversation on stage, but you were talking about the importance of humor, which is, you know, has a Darwinian purpose. But you were talking about how dangerous the social justice movement becomes because of the fact that there is no humor. And I think I'm paraphrasing what you said, but you said something. You be wary of a group that is humorless. Because you can't.
Nothing scares me more
yeah.
about this movement than the fact that it does lack a sense of humor about itself or apparently mm-hmm. anything else.
Yeah. It's frightening. The perfect example, I sent this to you. I don't know if you had a chance to read it about there was a UK professor at a conference in San Francisco in an packed elevator. He did that kind of lame dad joke, you know, when somebody says, what floor? And he said, ladies' lingerie. And a gender studies professor filed an actual formal complaint in which the organization putting on the conference agreed and are demanding an apology, which he thankfully, I mean, it's for now anyway, refuses to give. And I think that's a pretty perfect example of what you're talking about.
It's stunning
yeah.
that someone got in trouble. It's not even that he invented a joke and it treads in some sort of dangerous territory. It's a long-standing classic joke, and if it has somehow become illegitimate to make that joke, we would need to understand why. I mean, it's not as if there aren't lingerie stores in the mall, right?
Yeah.
How did this suddenly become something that is beyond the pale? I can't fathom it.
Yeah, I just hope he stands firm and doesn't give in. Another kind of area that you touched on in one of your lectures, and I've noticed this come up in a number of different books, including like Jordan Peterson's, and I saw a buddy of mine wrote a book on parenting, but you also brought it up too, and that is how integral delayed gratification is in creating, you know, a beneficial society. And it made me think when I was going to ask you this question, because you are a progressive, and I wonder when you talk and you're a scientist, and when you talk about the importance of delayed gratification, what do you look – when you look back at the 60s and the 70s, which were – seemed like an era that kind of mocked the idea of delayed gratification. Am I right to say that? Should we have regretted certain decisions we made back then?
Well, you know, the situation was what it was, and people reacted to it as they thought. In mm-hmm. retrospect, I do think there was a kind of obsession with – immediate gratification, and it has destroyed the wisdom that we now need so clearly.
Mm-hmm.
So I would say the first thing is just to simply recognize that that happened, and that the consequence, I would argue, is that it has taken many highly desirable things and it has replaced them with a junk version of it. Mm-hmm. So, you know, if you think about junk food, well, we have junk relationships and junk romance, and basically everything has been turned into a kind of junk parody of the original by virtue of the fact that people have sourced a some sort of a quickly but not very satisfying answer to whatever it is they're seeking, mm-hmm. and they have lost the taste for what one can discover if one is willing to be patient and seek it in some sort of deliberate fashion. Mm-hmm. That is part of what this new conversation is about. These are more difficult answers to access, and getting to them in 5 minutes may be impossible. Yeah. Sometimes 3 hours is necessary.
Yeah, definitely. And when you talk about these things, you sound vaguely apocalyptic and pessimistic at times. I think I've heard you say, you know, if we want to survive the next 100 years, ... And, you know, I'm listening to this and I'm going, he's a smart guy and he's scaring the crap out of me. And I think it's – I tried to you know, figure out what you were saying. And I sense like the argument you're making, and you should make it, not me, is that – We're developing technologies now that, you know, still, but we're still these evolutionary animals, and we're still governed by natural selection. And combining that with this new technology may not end well. Am I saying this correctly?
I would say there are a couple of things that are combining mm-hmm. to spook me. And I will say, I do think there is time for us to wrap our minds around this puzzle and to solve it. But I'm concerned that we won't, because we are so comfortable in the present. Mm-hmm. So Steven Pinker has made the point very eloquently about how the present actually has a lot to be said for it in terms of its delivering on human needs. And that's not wrong, but it means that to the extent that it is usually, you know, in human history, hunger would be maybe the first sign that your civilization was faltering. Mm-hmm. Well, we have the opposite of hunger. We have an overabundance of food, and it misleads us with respect to other hazards. And those hazards are of a type that we're just not prepared to understand, mm-hmm. because nothing like them has ever existed. We have high-tech tools that can be much more destructive than anything our ancestors, even a few hundred years ago, could have imagined. And we're also networked in ways that mean that things can cascade across civilization. Mm-hmm. You know, the power, as long as it's on, doesn't require us to do much thinking. But if we had, let's say, a solar storm that knocked out transformers, we could have the grid for a third of the nation go down all at once, and my understanding is it might take 6 months to bring it back up because the transformers can't be sourced quickly. Mm-hmm. So that's a serious problem that we don't intuit, because the power is so reliable in general, and yet it looms outside of our view. And it's a very simple example of something of which there are many that are more complicated. But what we should be doing is anticipating the new dangers that we face by being interconnected in the way we are with technologies that are unprecedented. Mm-hmm. And a lot can be done at much lower danger if we become aware of the danger and we deal with it proactively rather than waiting for disaster to alert us that we've miscalculated.
I think that should be the title of your book, which it should be called The New Dangers and How We Face Them or Solve Them, something like that. But I'm not your book agent. I'm just throwing out ideas. I like – you have an interesting concept when you're talking about engaging people that you disagree with or may not disagree with. I'm in cable TV where everything has to be a debate. You're more interested in a dialogue, and you have this concept which I found very appealing, steel manning. It's the opposite of straw manning. It's when you portray the opposition's idea in the best possible light. In a way that maybe makes your position stronger, because it's kind of like going to the gym. You're working out with heavier weights. And you did this, I think it might have been on Rogan's show. You were talking about climate change skeptics. I put myself I would say I'm a lukewarmer. I'm not a skeptic, but I'm a lukewarmer. But the way you articulated the skeptical stance was the clearest I ever heard it. I think you said something, because I'd been working in health magazines, and that had made me a skeptic about any kind of claim. When I heard a claim about vitamins or exercise, I was very, very skeptical. And I think that bled into the way I interpreted any kind of climate, popular articles on climate change. And you kind of steel-manned it for me. Do you remember what you said?
I think I remember the discussion you're talking about. Mm-hmm. And my point would be, as an insider to science, mm-hmm. and somebody who has also studied complex systems, there's plenty to worry about with respect to how high quality are the models that we're using to anticipate climate change, how immune to corruption are the fields in which these things are studied. Mm-hmm. And I have those fears because I've seen corruption inside of science. I've seen models that appear to indicate something and aren't right. On the other hand, there's a lot of reason to believe that anthropogenic climate change is real that isn't based on difficult models. It's based on relatively trivial matters of chemistry. Mm-hmm. There's also, for example, the craters that have opened up in the Yamal Peninsula of Siberia. So mm-hmm. some process is resulting in novel geology so new that we don't even have a name for the structures in question. Mm-hmm. And the hypotheses that have been tested suggest it is the sudden explosive release of methane that has created these new craters, which were ironically discovered by petroleum workers. Mm-hmm. But in any case, my point would be, I believe in climate change. I'm worried that the science isn't perfect. Mm-hmm. But if I think about what the implications are in terms of what humanity ought to do, the accuracy of the models is not actually important in terms of figuring out how it is that we should approach this problem. Mm-hmm. Climate change is one of many places where human beings are radically altering the face of the Earth. Mm-hmm. And we have been scared, we have been scared away from solution making by the idea that to shore up our mechanism for living on this planet would require us to face great austerity, mm-hmm. which it wouldn't. It might actually result in tremendous innovation and ultimately some kind of stable abundance. So my feeling is, what we do about climate change and maybe more importantly other environmental issues is not really contingent on the details of these models or even their accuracy. It is necessary because we keep unleashing new processes that have consequences we can't anticipate. Mm-hmm. And it is time. The founding fathers of our country, for example, couldn't possibly have anticipated the technologies that we now routinely deploy. Mm-hmm. You know, they hadn't seen a chainsaw, much less one of these machines that can, you know, pluck and strip a tree in a matter of 30 seconds. So we have to rein in processes that alter the globe in radical ways that can't be undone. Mm-hmm. And that is completely consistent with making the world habitable in a way that it doesn't degrade from one generation to the next. That mm-hmm. should be our job, whether or not anthropogenic climate change is what we think it is. So given that what we ought to be doing is not contingent on the details of those models, my feeling is we should address these problems in a general sense,
right,
rather than wait to be certain of the models, which, you know, at the point we're certain, it may well be too late.
Yeah, and the what you said was, I'm trying to remember, but it was like you understood, okay, there are intelligent people who are naturally skeptical because of the force of the emotion or righteousness of the other side. If the other side is well, of course these models are correct, or of course I am right, of course, and the skeptic, a naturally intelligent skeptic, pulls back, and it's not necessarily their fault for pulling back, because that's what you would normally do. Is that kind of what you said, maybe?
Now I remember the conversation yeah. you're talking about. Yes, that the skeptics naturally detect that there's something overly forceful and agenda-driven on the other side. And the natural reaction is to resist when somebody is attempting to claim a level of certainty that they clearly can't have. And unfortunately, that natural reaction not to be pushed into believing something that might not be right is causing us to miss the opportunities that we should avail ourselves of in addressing these problems.
Exactly. Because that's the first time I've ever heard anybody understand like where my skepticism comes from is not some kind of irrational reaction or I'm on a team. Like, this is my team sport. Republicans think it's a hoax, so I'm going to say that. This is something before I was remotely interested in politics was that I was just in health journalism where I read studies and I read what happens to studies when they enter the hands of an editor trying to write a cover line. And that changed the way I viewed everything. And so when I heard like, you know, people that were 100% positive about something, about anything, that made me suspicious. And I think that's like it drives me a little crazy when I'm accused of being either, you know, simplistic or in denial, when in fact I'm just going by something that I think is a pretty good skill to have, which is always to have a raised eyebrow, I guess.
Yes, and to be aware of how certain you are about things. And anytime you hear yourself say that you're 100% certain, it's really got to be a very simple process for you to be 100% certain of anything precise.
Yeah.
So it's amazing how much headway you can make in discussion with somebody where you disagree with them if you both confess how much uncertainty you have on a particular point. You hear somebody on the other side say, I'm 98% sure, you suddenly, there's an opening there.
Yeah.
Because then you can begin to figure out what you actually disagree about and what you agree about. When somebody says that they're 100% sure, either they're not self-aware or they are representing themselves as extremely certain in order to buttress an argument. And that's not a logical thing to do.
You know, speaking of certainty, I only got one or two more questions left. And I wanted to talk about you had mentioned in a talk the importance of undergrads being at a university because they ask the questions that the older, more experienced student or scholar has already dealt with. So that they forget about the basic questions because they're fairly certain that they already have the answers. But it's these basic questions asked by the fresh mind that keeps your skills fresh. And I wanted to make this correlation because I think that this applies to politics. And I really do think that the reason why so many people missed the 2016 election, including myself, was that we listened only to the experience, the people like the pollsters and the analysts, and we didn't listen to the amateurs, i.e. the non-political people. I have my producer waving her hand because she owns a bar, and she's like, she's the regular person, and she's like, you didn't listen to me. And is that correlation fair?
Absolutely. There is a way in which, in order to do what experts do, they surrender the ability to see what they're not expert in. Mm-hmm. And so this works with undergraduates. They haven't embraced the assumptions of the field yet. And this is very important. When a field gets stuck, you have to figure out which assumptions are wrong. But if you've forgotten that you've made assumptions in the first place, you're not going to be able to do it. So yes, we have to step away from our love affair with expertise. Mm-hmm. The more stuck we are, the more we need to engage with alternative ways of thinking. And then when one of these alternative ways of thinking turns out to correctly predict something that the experts miss, you have to figure out whether it was just a lucky guess, in which case there's nothing to be done, or whether actually there is some method that has value that we have yet to recognize, in which case the people who predicted correctly should be elevated, and we should listen to potentially their predictions on other things.
Yeah, I it changed the way I look at things, and it for obvious reasons, because it was such a jarring, phenomenal experience when something like that happens, and you have to it causes you to, where did I go wrong? And I realized I went wrong by not listening to people I wasn't working with. I was listening, and I had after the Brexit thing happened, I went to an analyst who I said, Jesus, this has to be some kind of foreshadowing. He said, no, Greg, that's a referendum. Referendums are different than elections, so you can't draw any conclusions. And I said, yeah, but I mean, what about the silent like the quiet voter? Aren't they similar in that the quiet voter might have said he wasn't going to vote for Brexit and did, and that could be the same thing with Trump? And the analyst said, shut up. That's what he said. He just said, shut up. And I said, okay. And I did. I did shut up. I actually did shut up. I decided that I let it go. And speaking of which, I'm being waved that I have to go. Somebody's now needs this studio. I just got a finger waved at me. Where can we find you, Dr. Weinstein?
Well, the easiest place to find me is probably to follow me on Twitter.
Uh-huh.
I have a YouTube channel and a Patreon, and I tend to announce things that I'm doing in public in those places.
Yeah. Is there going to be a book soon?
I'm hoping that there's going to be a book soon. There are actually a couple books that I'm working on, and the question is which one is the need for greatest.
Excellent. Well, I look forward to reading it. I will buy it, and then you got to come on and talk about it when it comes out. Been a pleasure talking to you. I'm a big fan of everything that you're doing, and I'm, like I said, I'm glad you left the college. I never would have heard of you. So I think you have when I said students, I meant, you know, as a general term, you've got a lot more students than you probably will ever had if you had been at Evergreen.
I appreciate that, Greg, and I'm happy to come back on. That will be a fun discussion as well.
Awesome, sir. Well, thank you so much.
All right. Thank you.
Take care.